The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, everybody, it's Gabe from Thinking Outside the Long Box, and you get to listen to the sultry, sexy sound of my voice for quite some time. This is going to be a special interview episode. We had so many interviews that we didn't want to, like, send you, like, an eight-hour-long episode with, like, four interviews in it. So instead, you get one very special interview episode with three people that we're pretty stoked to talk to. We're going to talk to Ross, Joseph Gardner, and Heath Hale. They're the creators of A Place in the West, which is a Half-Life tie-in comic book that sounds really cool. I read the first issue of it, really enjoyed it. We talked to David Lucarelli, creator of Children's Vampire Hunting Brigade, which is based, bizarrely enough, on a true story about some kids that go vampire hunting in Scotland. Super fascinating true story, and on top of it, a really great interview about a cool comic book. And of course, the big interview for this particular episode is with Sam De La Rosa, artist extraordinaire. He's done Spider-Man, he's done Venom, he's worked for DC and Marvel and Dark Horse and just anybody that you can think of. He's drawn Star Wars, he's drawn Dreadstar, he's done it all. Like, he's awesome, really great guy to talk to, and he will reveal to you the one character that he's never gotten a chance to draw that he really wish he would have. So stay tuned for this episode. It's really good, I promise you. I'm not as boring when I'm talking to other people as when I'm talking to myself. All right, everybody, on the line we have Ross Joseph Gardner and Heath Hale, the writer and artist for A Place in the West. Guys, how are you this morning, or this evening for you, Ross?
I'm pretty good. The sun is shining, but it's not warm because it's England. But apart from that, I'm okay.
Nice. Heath, how are you?
How about you guys?
I'm good. Utah's kind of cold right now, but kind of the same.
Yeah, I feel you. We're in Colorado. It's chilly, sunny but chilly. So,
but it will get warm, right?
Eventually, I believe.
Yes.
So, we kind of like to start all of our interviews with, you know, the same basic question. What is the superhero origin story of your project, A Place in the West? What I mean is, like, kind of what's the starting point for the project, not like the heroes in the project.
As to where the initial idea for it?
Yeah.
Well, my co-writer is not here right now. We are huge Half-Life fans, and we spent a lot of time in the modding community making Half-Life mods, and we wanted to create our own. We originally wanted to create our own comic, but it's very expensive to create comics, and a lot of the conceptual work would have taken a lot of time and a lot of money. So we were like, you know what? Why don't we just do a Half-Life comic? You know, because it's been a long time since there's been a Half-Life production from Valve, so we thought it would be a good space to fill. And it just sort of went from there. It was like, well, what can we do with Half-Life that hasn't been done before? And the first thing that came to mind was America. We'll put it in there, and we'll put it in the intervening years between the two Half-Life games, Half-Life 1 and 2, and see what we could come up with.
And for you, Heath, what was kind of the jumping off point for you with this project?
Well, honestly, I just needed some work at the time. So they had a posting, and I applied, and they accepted me.
Nice. Hey, that's always the best way to get work, is when someone posts a job and you accept it. So
yeah. Yeah, we actually turned down a number of jobs that have been posted to me because a lot of people really don't know what they're asking for when they ask you to do something, the same way as when you find someone who is looking for an artist out in the open, so to speak.
Nice. So, Ross, you talked about how you had been pretty heavily involved in, like, the modding community for Half-Life, and how you had wanted to do a comic book already. You know, what kind of drove you to push those two things together? Like, was it just the desire to do both, or was it, you know, what made you arrive at, let's make a Half-Life comic?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'd seen Valve had been producing Dota 2 and TF2 and Left 4 Dead comics, and I was wondering, like, you've got this huge universe, which is very ambiguous, and where are those? And I'm sure they have their reasons for not doing that. In fact, I think they've been quite vocal about why. But for me, I thought, well, I've always wanted to do comics. I've always wanted to work in comics. I've always wanted to write for comics. I have no artistic skill whatsoever. And Mike and I really loved the idea of bringing in a lot of kind of Half-Life iconography whilst also introducing a whole lot of new stuff. So yeah, that's just the ability to tell a Half-Life story that was unique to us without treading on the toes of what Valve had already done just made sense. And in terms of the modding community, like Half-Life-wise, there's actually been someone just released a new mod like a couple of days ago, Transmission something or other, but it's really brilliant. But apart from that, the gameplay within the modding community tends to stay quite static. It tends to be quite Half-Life. So you're shooting zombies, you're fighting combine soldiers, you're just playing kind of deviations of Half-Life. So I thought this would just be a new way to look at the Half-Life universe. And I thought comics, like the comic book medium would be perfect for that. And I'm pretty happy with how it turned out.
Nice. With this, it sounds kind of like this is your first comic that you've ever done. Is that correct?
That is absolutely 100% correct for me and Mike. Yeah.
And Heath, have you worked on other comics in the past or?
I've had a few, my biggest project was actually, I just graduated from college this year, and I did a senior project that was a 40-page comic called Empty Sands that I printed, and, you know, it was a long endeavor, a couple of years, so.
Nice.
And it was good. It was good.
As somebody that's that, you know, has done your own comic and, you know, like kind of a creator-owned comic and then has gone on to do, you know, another project, you know, is comics kind of the direction that you want to, you know, take your career as a recent graduate, or do you want to branch out into other things?
Oh, I absolutely want to do comics. I have a number of other projects that I want to do on my own or with some writers that I know. So, you know, I comics are, I love the format for the storytelling. There's just something about the images telling the story and contributing to the text and the prose kind of writing.
Nice. As you know, as a Half-Life comic, like, you know, branded as like kind of a storyline that goes with Half-Life, I know that, you know, Half-Life as a game is like available to open source, and, you know, the company is, you know, really embraced that in a way that, you know, games hadn't really embraced that before. Is there any involvement from Valve with your comic?
No, none whatsoever. I think Valve are very, very specific about, you know, it's their universe, and they're very protective of it, obviously. And I think they've made some fairly grounded comments in the past about how they, you know, whatever story there is, it's within their games. And, you know, canonically speaking, whatever they do, they want to stay within that. But I think they've been remarkable, personally, in terms of, as you said, embracing what fans have done. Like, you've seen the, you know, I think they did a Black Mesa mod, like a source version of that. That's now on Steam to download. You've got Minerva, which I don't know if you guys have played, which is a very fun man, Adam Foster. He was hired by Valve. So there's no involvement whatsoever from Valve's part. It's an entirely fan based production. But we've had some very nice comments from them and a nice smile from the legal team, which made me
they didn't sue us. So.
Yeah, they didn't sue us. We're not in jail.
You didn't get the cease and desist.
Well, I was very frightened of that, but I was like, well, if you can do a mod about it, I guess you can do a comic about it. And I got an email from Mark Laidlaw, the lead writer on Half-Life, and he said, oh, by the way I just got this from legal. These guys seem like they're a little unsure of where, because we put like on our original website, we had like a disclaimer saying this has nothing to do with Valve, nothing at all, I promise. And legal sent one back saying, don't worry, you're fine. So I relaxed.
Nice.
I relaxed. Yeah, but they've been, you know, they spread it around the office, and we've had some nice comments from them.
Very cool. Do you think that, you know, a non Half-Life fan, like somebody that hasn't really played the game, you know, doesn't really know anything about the game, do you think that they will find the comic book accessible?
That's my perspective.
Well, I mean, Heath, because Heath hasn't played Half-Life, so I guess I'll let Heath answer, and then I'll tell you what I think afterwards. So, Heath, over to you.
I found it to be fairly accessible. There were things that I didn't know and didn't understand, and kind of had to just accept. But as the artist, I had to look into these things a lot to make sure things were like accurate. You know, like the antlions and the headcrab zombies and things like that. So I had to get familiar with it, even though I hadn't played it. So I would say it's fairly accessible. You know, I think where it's going to go in the future will be more so, frankly, but...
Yes. I think one of my problems with issue one was always that it didn't really... You know, we didn't want to kind of take like 5 pages out to explain what Half-Life was. But we always wanted it to be accessible to people who weren't familiar with Half-Life. So we took the decision to take a minimalist approach with what had happened during that game and that story, and kind of drop little details in here and there about the world, because the characters in the comic, obviously, you know, this is well before Half-Life 2, so they don't really know what's going on either. They're in the dark as much as perhaps the non-Half-Life fan is, so we were relying on that. But going forward, there'll be stronger connections to the Half-Life universe that will be explained, contextualized within the comic, that I hope will allow non-fans to feel like they understand what's happening, you know. And ultimately, I guess all you really need to know is alien invasion, things have gone wrong, you're under occupation. So long as we can tell our story without compromising Half-Life and simultaneously telling Half-Life's story bit by bit, we should be okay. But it's been a really tricky thing to do, writing-wise. That's been one of the biggest hurdles, frankly. I don't know, I mean, are either of you guys Half-Life fans? Or have you played the games? Or
I've played it in, like, kind of a cursory fashion with one of my friends who was really, really into it. Like, but, I mean, honestly, when I play video games, I play JRPG stuff as opposed to first-person shooter stuff. So, you know, it's not really my thing. I read the first issue and enjoyed it because, like you said, it starts in that kind of ambiguous place where, like, the characters, you know, they're referencing stuff that, you know, mentally, because I know it's a Half-Life comic, I know it's referencing things in the game, but because I'm not familiar with the game, it just doesn't matter. Like, it's, you're learning about a new world just like you would with any other comic book. So I found it quite accessible. So
that too is such a relief. Thank you.
Yeah.
it's great to hear that. Yeah. It's a question we've asked people, you know, can you read this and get it?
Yeah.
But hopefully the focus was, you know, I guess a question to you would be your involvement perhaps was it more with the Half-Life content or with the kind of the more original stuff, the stuff that wasn't?
For me, the involvement was just with the characters and the story. Like, it's interesting to see where it's going. You know, it's interesting to, so here's these people. They're clearly in some kind of like post-apocalypse where aliens have invaded. You know,
yeah.
There's apparently 2 teams of aliens, which I thought that was kind of a cool little thing. It reminded me a little bit of Falling Sky. I don't know if you've seen that show or not, but...
I haven't, no. It's been recommended to me, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's kind of the same concept where there's like an alien invasion, and then there's like kind of an alien insurrection, and that's kind of cool. And I really liked, you know, just this ambiguous, you know, his daughter has been kidnapped, or his son has been kidnapped, and they need to go figure out what's going on, you know, and that was cool. Like, I like that kind of open-ended involvement with it. So
great. I'm glad we're slowly striking the right balance. Nice. Hopefully we'll get to a better place. But yeah, there are many factions at play, and it's a balancing act.
Heath, a quick question for you. You had mentioned it a little bit. Having so much Half-Life source material, like, you know, what the creatures look like, what the, you know, kind of what the world looks like and that sort of thing, has it been easier to work with so much source material, or is it kind of difficult to, like, work within the confines of it?
That's kind of a hard question. It would depend on what it is. Sometimes... I think as someone who hasn't played, there are maybe some visual connections I could have made and I didn't. But while drawing it, there were a lot of things that it was nice to be able to see, like to look up or find the reference for what I'm looking for, so that it may not have been like in-game model accurate, but hopefully to give the feeling of it. Well, at the same time, almost like not the same feeling as Half-Life. I didn't want it to feel like the game. I wanted it to feel like something else that's its own separate thing in the same world. Kind of like, I guess, kind of like how the Clone Wars feels different than the Star Wars movies, visually stylistically, just because of the different approach and medium. The 3D characters look very different, but give it kind of a unique quality that is separate from, you know, what you see in the movies. I was hoping our comic would have some of that because of the different medium, the different story, and the different approach to it.
Nice.
So
like a little bit six of one, half a dozen of the other kind of.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
I feel like it would be kind of, I'm not an artist, so I don't really know, but I feel like it'd be tricky to like match things up, you know, this looks like this, you know, do you ever have that fear of like Half-Life fans being like super nitpicky about your comic, you know, in either sense, like as a plot, you know, device, or as, you know, visually, you know, well, the crab head zombie doesn't look quite like it should. And, you know, are you afraid of that, or have you gotten any of that?
I haven't gotten any of it, but I was a little afraid. There actually a particular thing, the gun that the main character or semi-main character Kempinski uses, I should have gotten better reference of that. I used the in-game models as reference for it, and I should have actually just looked up the real gun because the drawings are a little lacking because the models in-game are just, they were low resolution, old, couldn't have the same detail.
Right.
So I don't know if anyone noticed that, but I did.
Right.
So hopefully no one is being too nitpicky about it, but you know, if they are,
if they are, you haven't heard it yet.
Yeah, and I should probably know so I can fix it.
As far as feedback goes, we didn't get anything back on like visually this should look like this or that should look like that, but we did have a few kind of nitpicks. Like there was the two that stand out for me was why are there antlions in the snow, which I thought was odd because, you know, Half-Life 2 is in City 17 and that's in Eastern Europe, and I was like, it's freezing there. And I think the other one was they wouldn't be using the word combine yet because it hadn't become a term or something. But prior to going into the kind of comic, it was like, we're just going to have to accept this. There are fans, you know, and our audience are primarily Half-Life fans. So they're going to have that response. And we're going to tread on, because it's an ambiguous universe, and we're going to tread on ideas that people have of these creatures. So can an antlion survive in the snow? I don't know if it can survive, where it can survive, you know.
Valve didn't tell us.
Valve did not tell us.
So,
and, I think, you know, and I sent them 50 emails asking about it.
Like, if Valve
can an antlion
say
survive
it's
in the snow? And they just didn't reply. But no, it's just one of those things you have to roll with, right?
So with the amount of like kind of post-apocalyptic, you know, alien invasion, zombie invasion, you know, all that, are you afraid of your comic kind of getting lost in the shuffle of that? Or are you, you know, because it has that connection with the Half-Life community, you know, do you feel like that's going to kind of push it to the right niche audience?
Do you mean will we get lost in the middle of kind of post-apocalyptic genre fiction in general?
Yeah, like of the you know, comics like The Walking Dead or Dark Engine or like, you know, any of the other,
sure,
you know, gajillion comics that take place in a dystopian sci-fi future world, you know?
Yeah, well, we never wanted to, as regards the kind of post-apocalyptic scene, you know, it is a well-beaten genre. I think we can all sort of agree with that. We're seeing so much of it now, aren't we? In films, in comic books, in games, it's all there. On the one hand, we can rely on Half-Life's relatively unique take on it. It's quite an interesting spin, but we don't want to use it as a crutch. And I would say that the first issue is more Half-Life than any other, even though the Half-Life storyline will get clearer. Conversely, we're going to move into a space where the kind of post-apocalyptic aspects of it will diminish in, well, how to say it really, we're pushing into a very new place. You know, once you get to Franklin, once you get to the city, all the action will take place there and we'll never go outside of it. We'll never go back into the wilderness. So it becomes more of an urban drama once you get, so hopefully that'll keep things unique.
Very cool.
I think the Half-Life name and content actually does give it a niche audience that is very helpful for, I mean, just the word of mouth that it got as opposed to other self-produced comics. I mean, my own, the comic I did for my senior project was also post-apocalyptic. And it's, I would say, kind of lost in the shuffle. It's hard to distinguish if you don't have, Half-Life has a built-in audience, kind of. And that, I think, was very nice for us with this comic, was that there's an audience who wants to read it before they've seen anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, we had to rely on that audience as well. It was a, you know, it would, you know, I've I feel for people putting out these kind of original comics, so many of which are great, and maybe not getting the readership that they deserve. But we found that just putting Half-Life on the title, it got us a lot of hits. You know, we did anticipate, you know, no point skipping around that fact. We knew that would be a thing, and we hoped it would help.
So,
I didn't know that.
Right.
Surprise, Heath. Surprise.
I just thought it was a job. I didn't know Half-Life was so popular still.
Yeah, like, still.
How many years later is it? 10, 15, 30? Who knows?
30.
Last probably feels like 30 for most people.
So we all got – all of our Facebook feeds and Instagrams got inundated with the Star Wars trailer. So we have been asking as a final question for everybody on our interviews, and we'll probably keep doing it until the Star Wars movie comes out because we're that excited about it. Who – you know, you're allowed to have whatever your opinion is, but there is only one right answer. Who shot first, Han or Greedo?
Oh, come on. Han shot first. Yes. I mean, Jesus Christ. I believe that somewhere in the Disney vault, they're not in the next batch of movies, but when they eventually revise them, Han will be shooting first again. That's the rumor that I heard.
I had heard that they were going to re-release them as originally filmed as well.
Well, now they're out of George's hand. Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, but really, didn't George Lucas shoot last? And that's what really.
Well played, Heath. Well played.
Can we just take the gun out of George's hand? Well, I guess that's happened. So.
Yeah. Thank God. Right. Well, guys, thank you so much for being on our show. Why don't you go ahead and let us know how people can, you know, find your comic book online, you know, get a hold of it, you know, read it, because it is a good read. I really enjoyed it. And that's
you.
Coming from a total, like, Half-Life devoid of knowledge other than I pick up a gun and shoot at my friend, except for he shoots me over and over again. how can we get a hold of your comic book?
Well, first off, thank you very much for having us. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm glad you enjoyed the comic. You can check out future updates on www.aplaceinthewest.net, which has access to our Twitter feed and other things. Issue 2 should start production in a few months. I should have the script done by the middle of next week. And now that I've said that out loud, that probably has to happen now. We are going to release a map, a small playable Half-Life map, which is tangentially related to the comic, which will be released in August to kind of keep people, kind of tide people over. So yeah, just check out our website, check out our Twitter account. We do not have a Facebook account, but apart from that, yeah. We are around, and hopefully people continue to read what we've done.
And Heath, as an artist, how can people find you?
I have my website, which is heathhale.com, H-E-I-L. And I'm on Twitter at Mr. Heath Vance, and I'm on Facebook under Heath Hale. And I think those are probably the best. I'm most active on Instagram, which is at Mr. Heath Vance as well.
Nice.
So.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, guys. We really appreciate it. And hope you guys have an awesome rest of your day or rest of your night, as the case may be.
Certainly will. Thank you very much for the privilege. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm April, and I won the My Nerd Room contest. You're listening to Outside the Long Box.
This is Ross from Half-Life: A Place in the West. This is from Thinking Outside the Long Box, a very great broadcast.
Hey, everybody. So on the line now, we have David Lucarelli, creator of Children's Vampire Hunting Brigade. How are you today, David?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Nice. So we like to start off all of our interviews with like the same basic question. What is the superhero origin story of like your project? Like what got the ball rolling for this?
Sure. Well, I was looking around the internet one night and I stumbled upon something called the Gorbals Vampire Incident. And what that is in 1954, hundreds of school kids in Scotland went looking for a vampire in this one graveyard. And it was considered mass hysteria. They blamed it on comic books at the time. And the youngest kid involved was only 4 years old. And I started thinking about that incident. And from there, sort of sprung the germ of the story that became the Children's Vampire Hunting Brigade.
Nice. That's super interesting. Like, it's such a weird story to kind of like draw from. I ended up looking up some of this stuff, and what a creepy, weird thing to have happen. Like all, like literally just bands of little kids with like homemade weapons hunting down this iron-toothed vampire. Like what a cool idea.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And as a matter of fact, just in the last few years, a comic book story from that time period called The Vampire with Iron Teeth has been unearthed. So it may be that the people that blamed it on comics were at least partially right.
Oh, weird. I guess I had missed that little piece of the history. That's pretty cool. So I know, the comic book revolves around like this brigade of like, you know, vampire hunters, and, you know, some of them are like kind of teenage vampire hunters. Do you often have your comic book compared to Buffy?
People have compared it to Buffy before, and I think that's valid. Certainly, Buffy and Joss Whedon in general are an influence. I would say that, it's been called Buffy meets S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders, and that's probably a little closer to the mark, because in our comic, the children in the 50s find what they're looking for. They form the brigade, and then a half century later, there's a couple of juvenile delinquents that are drinking in that graveyard the night the vampires come back. So they unwittingly become the newest members of the brigade in present times, and they are not the sort of wholesome middle-class teenagers of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, I think they're kind of lower class. They don't have a whole lot of career opportunities. And so for them, dropping out of school to fight vampires is kind of the equivalent to going on tour with their punk rock band or running away and joining the circus. Seems like a rational choice, especially when there's a couple of pretty girls in the mix and they're 16 and they still feel like they're going to live forever.
Nice. And of course, there are real vampires to fight. So
exactly.
That's awesome. I like, in general, just the idea behind the book is really cool. I love the, like, I kind of love the cool spin on a historical story. You know, when you were, you know, getting ready to like build into the project, when you were getting ready to start it, you know, was there any, you know, thematic ideas that you were really fixated on from the historical perspective? Was it just like the kids hunting vampire things, or did you take other little snippets of like the story and add them into the comic?
A combination of that inspiring me, and then also from my own misspent youth, I spent time drinking in graveyards and hiding on top of mausoleums, running away from security guards and that kind of stuff. So I was able to incorporate some real life experience into the mix as well.
Nice. It's kind of a write what you know.
Exactly.
I know all about the misspent youth. Spent all of high school and probably like 4 or 5 years after high school in punk bands. So,
like, oh, there you go.
Yeah. That's cool. With the artist, I know that the artist is, your artist is from the Philippines, correct?
Yes, Henry Ponciano.
Okay.
For those of you who haven't seen his art, he's got a little bit of a Mike Mignola influence going, if you like that. But he's really made the book his own. And actually, just speaking to somebody who told me there's a good chance he may get nominated for an award for Best Newcomer. So fingers crossed. I don't want to jinx it, but I think that he's a great artist and very much deserving of that. So, and that would be based on his work in Volume 1. I think his work in Volume 2 is even better.
Nice. What do you think, what do you think really drew you to his art style, particularly with this project? Is it just kind of that Mignola-esque, or was it, he really has like that darkness nailed? What really drew you to him?
I think our imaginations were very much in sync. What I did is I put an ad in the classified section of DeviantArt, and I was very much blown away by the talent that responded to it. But, a lot of comic book artists are great at drawing muscle-bound superheroes and beautiful women that look like they came from a Playboy, shoot, which is fine. But it was important to me to find an artist that could draw realistic-looking teenagers as well, and not people that looked like they were fashion models or, had just done a strongman contest.
Nice. So with going back a little bit into like the teenage vampire hunter aspect, Did you find yourself trying to like incorporate some of like that kind of social drama, you know, like the boyfriend girlfriend aspect or any of that kind of stuff? Or do you tend to remain like really focused on the vampire hunter part of the story? Like, you know, is there some of that like kind of teen angst drama to lend, you know, more credibility to the plot line? Or, you know, how's that working?
Well, ultimately, it's about a couple of teenage boys that are trying to find their place in the world, in a world that is oftentimes openly hostile to them even existing, right? So, yeah, definitely they're a little bit rough around the edges. And, you know, there's two main characters. There's Gavin and Doug. And Gavin is sort of the classic bad boy who, you know, drinks and spends all of his money on peroxide for his hair and buying obscure metal and punk CDs and knows how to fight and party. And the girls naturally like him. But in volume two, there's going to be a bunch of events that are going to happen to him that are going to force him to grow up a lot sooner than he would perhaps like. And as far as Doug, the Brigade is really his story. He is, you know, a little bit overweight and clueless with women, but he's also kind of the moral compass of the series in that he can always be counted on to do the right thing. And in volume two, what happens is the vampire threat escalates. The Brigade goes to America to search out a new potential recruit with a mysterious past, unaware that they're being manipulated by the vampires themselves. And what Doug finds out is that doing the right thing is going to become increasingly harder than ever.
Nice. It's cool. It's cool that you kind of like up the ante with like volume one versus volume two. Yeah. I know that
stakes are higher.
Right. Which is definitely the way to do it. So if you can't make the stakes higher, then why do a second one? Right.
Exactly. You know, one of the things you're trying to do in horror is disorient your audience to a certain extent. And I think that being in black and white kind of automatically does that, right? Because you're presenting a world that is already slightly different than what we're used to experiencing in reality. And there's a long tradition of great horror being done in black and white, everything from Psycho and Night of the Living Dead and the Universal classic horror films. You know, I think, now that being said, one of the rewards we did for the first Kickstarter for Volume 1 was that we published a version of Issue 1 that was done in full color, which I actually did the color myself because I'm a bit of a frustrated colorist and it was a fun project. But so we do have that reward for Volume 2 as well. If we make the goal, then I'm going to do like a digital edition of the first issue of Volume 2 that will be in full color as well.
Nice. So you had mentioned that, you know, once the third volume of the book is done, that's kind of like the end of the project.
Yeah.
What do you, you know, do you have any plans in the future to, you know, do different things, or do you want to expand this world? You know, what are your future goals with the comic books?
Well, right now I'm working on another project with the same artist, Henry Ponciano, and we're about 14 pages in, I think. And this is going to be a full color project, and we're going to be shopping it around probably at this summer's Comic-Con to various places. It's called Abigail O'Leary, and it is the story of one of the first female police officers. So it takes place in 1915. And a little historical background: in 1915, there were a few female police officers in Los Angeles. You had about 200 people on the force, and maybe two or three of them were female, primarily because you had a lot of underage teenage runaways and prostitutes that the male police officers were not really comfortable interrogating or patting down and stuff. And in Abigail O'Leary's case, however, she applies for that, and she's told, no, we're full up. You know, we already have our quota of two or three women. Now, in real life, Universal Studios at the time was kind of a proto-feminist organization in the sense that they had a female mayor, a female police chief, and they had some female police officers. They kind of saw themselves as being a self-contained city, even though the actual law of, you know, whether or not they were an actual city unto itself is a little bit of a gray area. So in our book, Abigail applies to Utopia Pictures, and she becomes a police officer on the studio lot there. So the tagline is going to be, Abigail O'Leary was one of the first female police officers in the country. They forgot to tell her it was never supposed to be for real. You know, because while they were female police officers, they were certainly not above marching them in parades and short skirt a la the Siegfried Follies to appeal to the prurient interests of the male tour attendees and things like that.
Nice. I'm noticing kind of a trend that you like to draw your plot lines kind of from, you know, real historical events or, like, you know, places and ideas. You know, is that kind of what you like to do, is to make effectively that historical fiction work for you, or?
Yeah, I think there's something about finding an interesting incident or period in history and twisting it just a little bit and saying, well, what if? And then going from there, because I think it kind of grounds it. I mean, this is not going to be a dry historical study by any means. This is going to be kind of noirish adventure. It's going to be sort of like L.A. Confidential meets Boardwalk Empire. And, you know, I also, you know, I draw from real life as well, because my mother was a police officer in Pittsburgh. So I know what it's like, you know, for a female to do that for a job. And I also, you know, grew up around a lot of police officers. I know what they're like and how they behave. And, you know, in the case of Children's Vampire Hunting Brigade, you know, Doug and Gavin in volume one, when we first meet them, they are drinking in the top of a mausoleum in a cemetery, running from the night watchman. And I may have done some similar things in the days of my misspent youth growing up in Pittsburgh, too. So
nice. No, we don't do things like that. What are you talking about?
Of course.
I sat at home and read comic books. I'd never drank illegally, kids.
Right.
So having a mom that's a police officer, do you think that informs, you know, your work, besides, you know, the obvious of making a comic book about a female cop? Or, you know, was she, you know, has she been supportive of you going into, like, a creative field? Or is she, you know, why didn't you become a cop, son?
No. She was always very supportive. And, you know, it's interesting. And she passed away a little bit over a year ago. But she would always say that there are good police officers, but that some of the people that she worked with were just as bad, if not worse, than the people that they arrested. So, you know, I think with all the recent news about unprovoked police shootings and brutality and whatnot, you know, her perspective was probably pretty accurate.
Huh. That's interesting. Like, it's, I mean, you know, as a person that, you know, has no family that's in, you know, the policing industry, it's interesting to hear the perspective of a police officer effectively reiterating what we see on the news. You know, it's
sure,
that's unfortunate, but real, you know?
Yeah. And, but, you know, again, that's not to say that there aren't good cops. I mean, I grew up knowing a lot of cops, and most of them were just trying to do the job the best they could. And, you know, were not racists or anything of the kind.
Nice. With, so going back to the comic book with,
sure,
with the second volume of Children's Vampire Hunting Brigade, it sounds like most of the work for it is done, and you're, you know, working towards getting the printing and stuff like that.
Exactly. The whole book is in the can. The only thing, you know, we have to do, like, page formatting, and we're looking for somebody to write the introduction, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's done. And I want to say I'm the guy that actually delivered everything for the first Kickstarter on time or early. So I'm, you know, I come from a background of being a musician and you know, a DIY kind of guy that put out 3 albums and a DVD. And so I'm very cognizant about allowing enough time to get everything done on time and delivering on all the rewards promised.
Nice. And just, you know, for people that haven't checked out your Kickstarter, what are some of the rewards that you're, you know, personally really excited about with this particular Kickstarter?
Sure. Well, you know, obviously on the lower end, you have, you know, digital copies of the book and hard copies of the book, all autographed, of course. And, you know, for anybody that's just getting into the Brigade now, Volume 2 is a self-contained story. You don't need to read Volume 1. But if you go to cvhb.net, you can read about the first 40 pages of Volume 1 for free right now. And you can add on Volume 1 either digitally or as a hard copy to any rewards level on the Kickstarter for the complete adventures. And then when you get up a little bit higher, we're going to have a pendant that is a recreation of the wood knife, which is the weapon that the Brigade uses to fight vampires with. And that's pretty neat because Henry designed that as a 3D model, and we're having those printed out. And then I'm going to do some hand painting and accentuation and stuff to make it even cooler. But cool. That's my first experiment with 3D modeling, and it's been kind of fun. So you can use that either as a pendant, or you could use that actually as a weapon for your action figures. It's about, you know, sized right for that.
Nice.
And then we're going to have T-shirts that are going to be full all over color printing using some of the latest printing technology. And on the upper end, you can pay to have Henry do a digital sketch of any of your favorite characters from the Brigade. At a certain level, I'll give you a phone call and I can talk to you all about comics and the Brigade and my day job as an audio engineer at Fox. I've been lucky enough to work on a lot of really cool movies over the years, like Batman Begins and The Avengers and Thor and Iron Man 2 and, you know, on the TV side, X-Files and The Simpsons and a whole bunch of stuff. So I can kind of give you a little bit of the inside scoop about that. And, you know, like I said, I'm a musician. So if hearing about me playing in a heavy metal band in Hollywood for the past decade sounds interesting to you, I could talk to you about that too. I have a few good stories there as well. So there's that. And then at the top tier, you can become a character in Volume 3, which I want to clarify, that doesn't mean you get, you know, a cameo appearance in one or two panels. For Volume 1 Kickstarter, we had only one reward for that, and the guy that did it, Aaron Downing, became an integral character in Volume 2. And we're going to actually have 3 rewards for Volume 2 that you'll be in Volume 3, and one of those rewards is already taken. So, you know, I promise you that if you take that reward, your character will not just be a cameo, it will actually be an integral part of the book.
Nice. That is very cool. So, wrapping up, you know, everybody's Facebook feeds and, you know, Instagrams and Twitters and whatever blew up with the Star Wars trailer this week.
Yeah.
So we've decided to end our interviews with the most important Star Wars question, you know, basically until the Star Wars movie comes out, because we're so fucking excited about it.
But, oh, yes.
The question, of course, being who shot first?
Oh, Han, of course.
3 for 3 today. Just want to say, yeah, I mean, 3 for 3, Han shot first.
You know, I get it. George Lucas became, you know, grandfather or whatever, decided that, you know, you can't have an anti-hero that just shoots somebody in cold blood, but you can. You definitely can. And that's such an integral part of who Solo is that, to change it is just ridiculous.
It's awesome. I'm glad that pretty much as a rule, everybody is like, George Lucas, stop it. Like, that's not cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So, now, have you guys seen, speaking of cool pop culture stuff, have you guys watched all 13 hours of Daredevil yet?
I am about 7.5 hours in.
Okay.
Juan is weird and doesn't have Netflix, and I can't speak for John because he's not here, but
okay.
I'm 7.5 hours into Daredevil, and it's phenomenal, like so good.
Yeah, it's I mean, I think it's a game changer. I think they have just raised the bar for all future, you know, TV superhero adaptions. It's myself, I was just, you know, the fact that they managed to capture so much of the spirit and the flavor of some of the best story arcs and people that have worked on the comics over the years, I was just, you know, talk about the internet exploding. And my Facebook feed was just full of people going like, I can't believe how good this is.
Yeah. What I'm super excited about, I'm a big Iron Fist fan, so I'm really, really excited to see some of those other spinoffs, like, you know, Power Man, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, all that stuff. That's pretty cool. I hope eventually it turns into a Doctor Strange series starring Benedict Cumberbatch, because that would be amazing.
I could see Cumberbatch doing a great Doctor Strange. I mean, who's the other guy that's been floated around? Johnny Depp has been talked about. He could do it too. He could be cool.
Yeah, he wouldn't be as cool. I don't
think. No, probably not.
That's
probably
just
not.
Me. He'd vamp it up too much, and I wouldn't like that.
There is always that danger. Yes, I know what you're saying.
So, David, thanks for chatting with us. How can people, you know, find your Kickstarter, find you on Facebook, all the different social medias? Like, how do we look you up?
Okay, so the easiest thing to do is to just go to Kickstarter and type in Age of the Wicked, and the project will come right up. If you want to read the first couple issues of the first volume online for free, just go to cvhb.net. And if you want to find me on Facebook, I think if you type in David Blake Lucarelli, I should come right up. But there's also links to all that stuff on the Kickstarter.
Nice. Well, David, thank you so much for being on our show. We really look forward to reading the second volume of your book. And me personally, I'll probably start hunting down that first volume too, because that true story of the vampire thing really piqued my interest. So.
Awesome. Well, you don't have to hunt. All you have to do is go to Age of the Wicked, and you can get volumes 1 and 2 on the Kickstarter.
Nice. Very cool. Well, David, thanks again for being on the show, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
This is Arlo, Barroom Hero from Ska Brewing Company, and you're listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box.
Hi, this is David Lucarelli, creator of the Children's Vampire Hunting Brigade, and you're listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box.
All right, guys, so we have on the line Sam De La Rosa, comic book artist extraordinaire. He's done work for basically every comic book company that you can think of, from Marvel to DC to Dark Horse. Sam, how are you doing this morning?
Fine, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome, man. So we start off all of our interviews kind of with the same question. What would be the superhero origin story of you, you know, drawing and inking comic books?
Well, you know, I've always gravitated towards Spider-Man, so I would think something along those lines. You know, I wouldn't mind getting bit by a radioactive spider and having the ability to just draw nonstop 24 hours a day. You know, and work on all my favorite superheroes.
Nice. So, as a kid, did you grow up drawing, or did you, you know, is it something you stumbled into as you got older, or are you like, you know, were you one of those kids that was busy doodling instead of taking notes like I was?
You know, I remember vividly in school, a grade school, as far back as the second grade. I remember drawing before that, but, you know, in the second grade, I do remember drawing, and other kids that drew, they sure got a lot of attention, you know? So I like that. So I enjoyed drawing as far back as the second grade. And then I just came across some comic books. So while I was drawing, you know, dinosaurs and wild animals and just unusual things like that, you know, comic books really caught my eye. And, you know, the colorful characters, you know, their fantastic powers. I just changed over to drawing comic book characters, and especially, you know, Spider-Man. I've been drawing Spider-Man since I was about 7 or 8 years old, but nobody paid me till, you know, years later.
Right. you know, over the years, you know, you've drawn a ton of stuff. You know, Spider-Man is, you know, you said is kind of kind of your favorite. What other characters have you like really enjoyed like drawing over the years?
Well, you know, it all has its basis on things that I enjoyed as a little kid. You know, so I was picking up Marvel comics really early on, and you know, paying for them on my own as a little kid. So I remember the first comic book that I can remember that I picked up and that I bought was Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man number 8. Cost me 12 cents, you know, and I remember it had a robot on the cover and Flash Thompson. And, you know, I've just been attracted to comic books from a really, really early age. And that's all I've ever wanted to do. And I didn't have any thoughts on doing anything else for a living. And luckily for me, it just worked out. And I think it just was very, very fortunate, because I know many, many people try to get into the comic book field, and many of them are very talented, but they still, you know, don't get in. There still isn't room for them. So I just always felt, you know, very fortunate.
Nice. So, you know, you've been in the comic industry, you know, for quite some time. Are there any guys that you've worked with that you just, you know, because I know you do a lot of inking. Are there any guys that, you know, when you do the inking over the pencils, you're just like, oh man, this is great. I love doing this guy. You know, I love working with this, you know, creator. You know, who have been some of your favorite people to work with over the years?
And again, it stems over to the emotional attachment I had as a little kid, you know, picking up the comic book. So anytime I got to work with people that whose comic books I picked up in the 60s, that was the most joy that I had. And, you know, I mentioned Spider-Man before. So I picked up Spider-Man, you know, in the early 60s. And in 1982 or 83, I finally got to finish a Steve Ditko story for Red Circle Archie Comics. So Steve Ditko penciled it, laid it out, and I finished it. And it was a story on a character called the Hangman. A not very well-known character. He's a Golden Age character. But, you know, hey, I got to work on Steve Ditko, you know, the co-creator of Spider-Man. And that's one thing I always remembered as a little kid. Not only did I like the characters, you know, the superheroes, but I liked the people that drew them and how they drew them. And I had favorites. I liked this person because, you know, he drew Spider-Man better than this other person. But I mean, I enjoyed all the art.
Nice. That'd be cool to work on Ditko stuff. Like, it's interesting, you know, you talk about Red Circle and, you know, the Hangman and stuff like that. You know, Archie Comics is working on re-releasing a lot of those characters under a new label called Black Circle. You know, have you?
Oh, okay.
Would you have interest in, you know, revisiting some of those like kind of more obscure Golden Age characters, you know, in your career?
You know, I enjoyed all the characters I got to work on, and I am familiar with many of the Golden Age characters because, like I said, I like the artist foremost, and then I familiarize myself with things they did, you know, beyond the things I saw as a little kid in the 60s, you know, things they did in the 50s, and some artists even go back to the 40s. So, but, you know, doing new work, it was a lot of hard work. I got to do, you know, hundreds and hundreds of comic books. I got to work over and with a whole lot of different people, you know, writers, editors, you know, pencilers, layout artists. And I, the comic industry as a whole, for the most part, they don't pay as well, you know. So I don't think I would enjoy putting in, you know, the same amount of work and getting paid less. And I just don't think I would do that. But I can still enjoy the characters and how other people draw them. And I'm still a fan for the most part.
Nice. So of the covers that you've done, like, you know, I love a lot of the covers. You know, I have, mm-hmm. you know, personally, mm-hmm. I have like Lethal Protector. I have the Dreadstar and Company, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, what's been your favorite cover to work on?
It's a tie. One is a cover, one is not a cover. So my favorite cover of all time has got to be the Lethal Protector number 1 image. So I just like that a lot, and people remember that. And it was published in early 1993 by Marvel, and they printed up, you know, over a million copies. So a whole bunch of people have that book and remember that book, and even at conventions, and some of them say they even, you know, tried to redraw that cover image. So that That ties with my favorite. The other image, it's not a cover. It was a poster celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Amazing Spider-Man. So it was this big, giant poster. It was 2x3 foot. But it wasn't sold. It was just given it to stores around the country for promotional purposes. But that image has been used dozens and dozens of times by Marvel throughout the years and for different, you know, marketing and different purposes. So those two are my favorite images.
Nice. So obviously you worked on Amazing Spider-Man 700, you know, huge key issue, you know, going into it, you know, it eventually turned into Superior Spider-Man, which then, you know, came full circle back into Amazing Spider-Man. And now huge, you know, there's the huge influx of like, you know, Edge of the Spider-Verse and, you know, Spider-Woman, Silk, Gwen Stacy. How do you feel kind of about the state of the Spider-Verse as it is right now?
Well, I think it's very exciting for a reader, you know, having read Spider-Man, you know, when he first began, you know, I think this storyline and the writers and artists are doing a great job to keep the interest in Spider-Man, and now with the Spider-Verse just makes it a lot more entertaining. You know, I picked up some books and I've got a stack of them. I just got to get to read them.
I hear that. But that's like every comic book fan's problem is the stack of comic books they have to get through, you know?
Yeah, you know, when you have a family and you have work to do and stuff like that, it's much harder now to keep up with, you know, the various storylines. But Spider-Man is one book or books that, you know, I pick up on a regular basis. So I think it's very cool. I enjoy it.
Are there any of the new, like, Spider-Verse characters, like Spider-Man Noir or Silk or Gwen Stacy that you would like to draw?
Definitely it would have to be Spider-Gwen. You know, I worked on you know, many stories with Gwen Stacy, so I think it's very cool that now she's this character. And at conventions, you know, I've worked on a print, so I offer that at shows. And then I also do, you know, commission artwork on Spider-Gwen comic book blanks. So I've enjoyed that. If you get a chance, you know, go to my Facebook. It's artist Sam De La Rosa, and you'll see some drawings on my timeline. And I also have an art album where I have about 100 sketches on there. But Spider-Gwen, I think I would really enjoy working on that character.
Nice. You know, as somebody that's been in the industry, you know, and kind of knows the ropes, what advice would you give to somebody that's, you know, looking to break into the industry as an artist or as a writer?
You know, it's much more difficult nowadays for both. It was always difficult for writers because the editors have to take more time to look at the material. For an artist, they could take a glance at it and they're professional enough where they just need a few seconds and they can tell whether, you know, it meets their criteria, their standards. So for artists, it's always been a lot easier. But in recent years now with the internet and, you know, being able to live in any part of the world, because you can scan your artwork, send it as a file to Marvel, it's made it a lot more difficult and competitive for everybody worldwide to break into Marvel. And that's also dropped the prices that the companies are willing to pay to artists. So they have, it's sort of like outsourcing. You know, they have artists in other countries, their standard of living is not as high. They may be able to pay them a bit lower. And Disney now own Marvel, and they're pretty frugal. You know, if they are able to get a very good quality artist in another country for a lot less than someone that lives here in the States with higher standards of living and cost, you know, it's a business decision. So I think they're doing that. So overall, it's very difficult to get the attention of Marvel, because the people that are going to hire you are going to be the editors, and they're not out and about for the most part at conventions. They may probably go to San Diego and maybe some New York conventions, but outside of that, I don't think you'll find an editor from Marvel or DC or Dark Horse anywhere in between there. So it's very, very hard to show your material and get interest. I know at San Diego, there's a lottery system to even show your portfolios to some of the big companies. So it's just like a rock star status. You know, you may or may not get your portfolio reviewed by a company. So overall, it's extremely difficult, but you got to have luck. You got to persist, and you definitely got to have talent and be as good as the artists that are already working for these companies. And if you're not, I mean, don't kid yourself. You know, you can still work at it, practice, and try to get to their level. So
nice.
That's what I think about that.
So you do a lot of conventions, you know, and you see a lot of people in general. How do you think like the convention culture, like, you know, things like San Diego Comic-Con or Denver Comic-Con, you know, in our area, how do you think that's kind of changing comic book culture? Like, do you see it becoming more popular than it used to be, you know, more acceptable to be a comic book fan?
Absolutely. All the above. You know, I started, my first convention that I went to as a fan was in 1971. It was a Houston comic book convention. I live in San Antonio, Texas, so it was about a 3-hour drive. So I was able to go with acquaintances, and, you know, I got to see some artists. I got to see Don Newton, an artist who went on to work for Charlton Comics and a little bit for Marvel, and mainly for DC Comics. I got to meet him, and I got to meet some, you know, TV and movie stars and other, you know, fan artists of the day. And I've seen, you know, conventions really grow. San Diego, I started going to San Diego in 1980, and I went just about every year all the way up to maybe 2007, and it just got very difficult with the amount of people and interest at that convention to find it enjoyable. You know, it's hard to move around when everybody else wants to do and see the same thing.
Right.
It's just so popular. I tell people there's a Star Trek episode, and I always forget the name of it, where, you know, there's a planet like that that's overcrowded and they're looking to expand, and that's kind of like the way I see some of the very big mega conventions. It's just gotten too big, and for me, they're not as enjoyable because they're so so popular. I guess that's it. They're just so popular.
It's kind of that idea that, you know, people are co-opting our stuff, like, you know, the nerds. You know, I've been reading comic books since I was a little kid, so now, you know, all the things that I really liked that people made fun of me for when I was a kid, now those are all really popular. It's like, no, that's my thing.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And I ran into the same thing. You know, I don't think as a little kid I overly publicized the fact that I enjoyed comic books. But I do remember that they sure helped me in reading, because I knew a whole bunch of big words as a little kid, and I still remember them. So I knew the most big words because I read the Fantastic Four, and Stan Lee just uses a whole bunch of big words, you know, and that helped. But
your teachers were like, where did a second grader learn the word radioactive?
yeah, you know, there's just a whole lot of big words and a lot of fun words. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed it.
So with the advent of all the, you know, the big Marvel movies and stuff like that, you know, has it been fun to see some of the comic creations that you've worked on, you know, on the big screen? Like, you know, especially Spider-Man, like that first Spider-Man movie was so much fun. And like, you know, how did it feel to see something, you know, I have a part of this history, like I help, you know, create and mold this character.
Absolutely. It's just a whole bunch of fun. You know, I can tell people, you know, while you have the movies, the source material is the comic books. So I'm just one of the people that got to work on these characters in Spider-Man, the Avengers, and Iron Man, and a whole bunch of guys. So anytime I see them on the screen, you know, it's just a whole lot of fun for me. And now there's an Ant-Man movie, and you know, I can go back and see that, you know, I also worked on some stories with Ant-Man as a character. So it's just a whole lot of fun to see that on the big screen.
Are you pretty? Wait here 1 second. My 3-year-old is being fidgety.
Sure.
Do you want to say hi, Sam?
Hi, Sam.
Okay.
Hi. How you doing? I got a 2-year-old myself. So far, it's safe over here.
So with the Ant-Man movie, you know, obviously technology has come so far, like with making these movies. You know, there's no way in the 60s or 70s they could have made an Ant-Man movie that wasn't terrible, you know, or just...
I know, you know, I remember in the 60s watching a TV show called Land of the Giants. So again, these were real tiny people in a situation where they're huge giants. And it looks hokey, you know, by today's standards, of course. So I got to see the Ant-Man trailer, and I see a whole lot of very cool you know, special effects and a little bit of the acting on the main character, and it looked great. It looked really good.
Nice. So as somebody that, you know, works for Marvel and does that, do you ever get any, like, inside track? Like, do you get to watch Age of Ultron, like, a couple days before or anything cool like that?
No, you know, some people ask me, hey, do you have anything to do with this movie or that movie? And I tell them, no. I just worked on the comic book, but as you can see in some of the movies, they take their influence from comics and, you know, they go their own route.
Right.
So the source, the basic material is in comic books, and I'm glad I got to work on a whole bunch of that stuff. And I see, you know, little bits and pieces pop up in movies that I got to work in comics, in comic book form. So I enjoy seeing that. It's a lot of fun.
Nice. So, you know, you've worked on tons of different, you know, titles and characters and stuff like that. Has there ever been like one character that you're just like, man, I wish I would have gotten a chance to work on, you know, whoever that is?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Just that character would have been Deadpool. I never got to work on any Deadpool stories, any story with Deadpool in there, or not even a cameo, anything like that. So I think Deadpool, I'm sorry, I missed the boat. I missed the boat on Deadpool. But, you know, at the time that Deadpool was co-created by my friend Rob Liefeld and Fabian Nicieza, you know, I was working on a lot of Spider-Man stuff. So I didn't have any time to work on anything else. And I was also turning down more work on Spider-Man because I was doing all I could.
Right.
So I don't think there was any opportunity or time for me to have worked on Deadpool. But I'm disappointed. I can't point to a story that I worked on with Deadpool. So I missed that.
That's kind of a bummer. Maybe someday in the future.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny. I just saw Rob Liefeld a couple of weeks ago. I was at WonderCon as a guest. And then I was at Fad Collectibles in Anaheim. And Rob Liefeld walked in, and I hadn't seen him I hadn't talked to him in about 20 years or so. I had worked on an issue of Supreme that he wanted me to work on. And I got to say hello to him. We took a picture. And pretty soon I'll put it on my Facebook.
Right. That's cool. You know, talking with, you know, all the different comic book artists and stuff, it's been really cool to, like, kind of come to the realization that these people that, you know, I've idolized since, like, you know, the 80s and 90s when I first started reading comic books, they're just normal people, you know, like you were a dad, you have a life just like everybody else. And it's cool to, you know, kind of see that inside track that, like, comic book artists aren't, you know, the bullpen, you know, at Marvel, like they used to kind of portray it in the letter columns at Marvel. Like,
is it
kind of nice with the convention circuit to be able to connect with the fans and just be like, hey, I'm just a guy like you? Is that nice?
It's very nice. It's very nice. And then I get a lot of nice comments. People post their comments and pictures on my Facebook page, and it's nice to hear that, you know, they identify with me. And I try to be as nice as I would like people to be to me. So I'd like that to be mutual, and it usually always is. So I have a great time connecting with people at shows. It's, you know, working decades as an artist in a studio, you don't really get any feedback. And while I was doing a lot of work, really can't do a lot of conventions, you know, because you have deadlines. So now I get to hear people, you know, how they felt, you know, on stuff I worked on, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So it's pretty cool.
Nice. As an artist, do you find yourself, you know, when you have a lot of work, when you have those deadlines, do you find yourself kind of like shutting down the rest of the world, or with our new kind of connected world where, you know, you always have Facebook, you always have your phone, you always have Twitter? Is that like a huge distraction that wasn't there before? Or,
well, you know, if you have deadlines, you just have to focus on your deadlines, do the best possible work you can on the material, because if it's not your best, if it's not very good, you won't get any more work. So you have to figure out what's important, what are priorities. And if you have work to do and a deadline to meet, you've got to get that done, whether it be in long hours or maybe a bit of just isolation, whatever suits you. You know, in the end, you just have to do good quality work within that deadline frame.
Nice. So we're all you know, connected to the internet, and we all got blasted with the Star Wars trailer this week. And, you know, us on the show, we're super excited about it. So we've decided that we're going to start wrapping up our interviews with the most important Star Wars question that anybody has ever asked. Sam, who shot first, Han or Greedo?
Oh, man. I would say it had to be Han Solo.
Yeah, Han shot first. That's right.
Yeah. That's what I think.
That's awesome.
And, I'm looking forward to the new Star Wars movie. I only got to work on three Star Wars comic books for Marvel, but I got to work on all the characters, you know, all the main characters, you know, Lando, Han, Princess Leia, Luke Skywalker, you know, Ewoks, just a whole bunch of the main characters. So while it was only three issues, I really enjoyed saying that, hey, I worked on Star Wars comics.
Nice. Are the Ewoks pretty fun to draw?
They are, you know, just little furry teddy bears, you know, with some accessories, just like Chewbacca, you know?
Just like tiny Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's awesome. Well, Sam, thank you so much for your time today. As we wrap up, you know, how can people find you? Like, what are some of the conventions that you're going to be at this year? How can we find you on Facebook?
Easily. Extremely easily. So my Facebook address is Artist Sam Villarosa. Search that, you'll find me. And my website is just my name.com. So if you can remember Sam Villarosa, add.com to it, or Google me, and you know, the same stuff will come up. So you can connect with me there. You send me a message. You know, my convention schedule is on samdelarosa.com. My next show, if you can get there, I can get you in free. It's in Guadalajara, Mexico.
Nice. If I could make it to Guadalajara, Mexico for a convention, I would totally go.
Yeah, I tell people, I usually do the Dallas Comic Con in May, but this time I'll be in Mexico City for a big show there. So I tell people, if they can make it at the door, I can probably get them in for free. But you have to get there on your own. So Mexico City in May.
It's as a kind of interesting question, because I hadn't really thought of this, is comic culture different in Mexico? Like, is that a different kind of experience, or?
It is. I've gone to one show in Monterrey, Mexico, and that show, while it was attended by thousands of people, was mainly an anime manga show. Huh. So the culture was geared towards that, but there were still, you know, many, many comic book fans. And I spent my summers in Mexico as a kid in the 60s, and there were comic books there. They were just a year behind the Marvel storyline. So I was able to pick up comic books in the 60s in Mexico. And nice. I think a lot of people are familiar with the characters and their origins in Mexico. Sure.
Nice. That's cool. I don't ever think about what an international con would be like. That's neat. I might have to make that happen someday in my life. So,
well, I'd like to know what it's like overseas in the UK, but so far I haven't been asked to go over there, but I'm hoping.
Nice.
I'm hoping.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sam. It is really a pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for your interest, and I wish you much, much success.
I'm Christopher M. Salas.
And Jason M. Montoya of Dennis Comic, and you're listening to Think Outside the Long Box.
This is Sam DeLaRosa, artist for Marvel in DC. You're listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box.
Hey, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. Be sure to check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/thinkingoutsidethelongbox, at Twitter or Instagram at @outsidelongbox, or you can email us at outsidethelongbox@gmail.com. I swear to God, someday I will get that right. So we hope you enjoyed the episode. We really enjoyed doing the interviews. We'll hit you up with a new episode soon. Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.